climate litigation has started a couple of years ago and now is a own term. We know what climate litigation means. And it was amazing because it just goes around the world like this fresh wind, and it just empowers people. It gives them wings. It makes them, it uplifts them, because young people, old people, everyone has suddenly the notion or feels like the single person can do something. Also, the individual can go out in the street, they can go through, they can do something. So climate litigation really started empowering the people and really started engaging people, because we understood that we can do something. So the idea with my law firm, Ocean Litigation, and what I specialize in now is to start the same, like, as you say, the wind of climate litigation. So we start the wave of ocean litigation, in which we start using the tool of law to protect the ocean.
Listen Up, der Podcast der Uni Potsdam. The Wave of Ocean Litigation with Dr. Anna von Rebay. Following her studies in Munich and a period working as a litigator, Anna von Rebay turned her attention to marine protection, a subject she then dedicated her doctoral thesis to here at Potsdam Uni.
Combining law and marine protection is, it really not only is the expression of my expertise that I studied so long, but it is just the absolute expression of my passions. I studied law for a long time, and well, I actually started studying law because I wanted to do human rights law. I had read, when I was a teenager, I read books by Angelina Jolie, and she was in, you know, she's very active in human rights. And I thought that was very inspiring. And I was wondering if I can do that, but I also wanted to study. So I thought, okay, if I study law, then I could do human rights law. And after I had finished my studies in law, for years, I had gone down this tunnel, this rabbit hole, and I had completely forgotten about my ambitions, why I wanted to study law. And I started working in this major law firm, huge international law firm. And at some stage, I was just wondering, I didn't know what I was doing there anymore. So I remembered, that was actually very nice. I took a time out and went to Bali for 2 months and did my yoga teacher training. And after that finished, I sat down at the beach by myself the first time after having finished this training and looked at the ocean, and had this moment in which I remembered that I wanted to study law because I wanted to be a human rights activist and not because I wanted to study work in a big law firm.
Back in Germany, Anna von Rebay abandoned her thesis in art law and sought an opportunity to do a doctorate in human rights law. This was how she met Professor Markus Schladebach, head of the research unit for public law, media law, and air and space law at Potsdam University.
And he called me and he said, you know, Anna, I find it very honorable that you want to do human rights. And this is very, very important. Don't get me wrong. It is so important. However, when you think of the environment, don't you think that also humans are only as well as the nature around them? And environmental law would be very, very important too. And this was this kind of opening moment in which I knew that specializing in marine protection, in the ocean, which I'm so, so, so passionate about with my private life, and law would be my path and the way that I want to go.
In her doctoral thesis entitled The Designation of Marine Protected Areas, a Legal Obligation, Anna von Rebay pursued the question of whether, under international maritime law, countries had a legal responsibility to implement measures to protect the oceans.
Marine protection itself also, of course, is a wide field, or big ocean. And at that time that I started looking for a topic, marine protected areas was something that was, still is something very popular and a topic that is talked about very much. I mentioned briefly this 30 by 30. It means that all members of the IUCN actually pledged that they want to designate 30% of the ocean by 2030. And as I had said before, in 2010, all states already pledged that they wanted to protect 10% of the ocean in the year 2020. But in the year 2020, only 7% of the oceans were protected. So I was wondering what impedes the progressive, the effective designation of marine protected areas. And as I have this background as a litigation lawyer, in which I worked many years and which is really a major passion, I thought, how can I hold states liable to do that? I don't want states to just say that. I want states to do that. And the law can be a very sharp tool, a very sharp sword to set pledges or obligations, statements of states also into practice, and into legally binding obligations. And so I set out to investigate if I can put this into practice and structure the whole thesis, actually. My whole doctorate thesis is structured a little bit like a case. So because I have these years of litigation, I didn't just write like an essay. I more or less wrote a huge case structured in a way that with the outcome, evidences that states must better protect the marine environment, and that one tool to do so is to establish marine protected areas. And under certain circumstances, states are really obliged in national law and international law to designate these areas.
The organization mentioned, the International Union for Conservation of Nature, is an international non-governmental organization which works to influence, encourage, and assist societies throughout the world to conserve nature and to ensure that any use of natural resources is equitable and ecologically sustainable. The goal of making 30% of our seas into marine reserves by 2030 is a key part of the EU's Green Deal's biodiversity strategy. But what are marine protected areas? And how do they need to be set up so that they achieve their purpose?
So marine protected areas, or marine reserves, are areas in the ocean in which human activities are restricted or not allowed. So this definition shows that what we are protecting is the ocean from humans. It is not the fish, it's not sharks that eat other fish or anything that we need to protect. Marine protected areas are areas in the ocean in which we protect the marine life from the damaging effects of human activities. They can be to protect specific species, they can be to protect specific areas, they can be protect specific regions or from specific activities. For example, areas in which no fishing is allowed. These are very effective. So we have different stages of protected areas. We have slightly protected areas in which, for example, everything is allowed, just no anchoring. So boats can go in, but they may not anchor. Or we have fully protected areas in which no human activity is allowed at all. When we think of the map of the ocean, and as I said before, you can sit there and really circle an area in the ocean and then call it a marine protected area. When that happens, the marine protected area exists on paper. Protective measurements, when the measurements are not getting enforced, so if there's no Coast Guard or if there's no effective protection measures, this marine protected area stays a paper park. So it never really has any effect. So in order to give them effect, we need one, fully protected areas, so protected areas in which no activities are allowed, and two, effective enforcement. We need people patrolling the areas. We need the states to really set it into practice and to really set in place protected areas. In fact, there have been studies suggesting that we should stop designating more protected areas in area and rather invest into enforcing the protected areas that already exist. Because otherwise, we could protect the whole, on paper, we could protect the whole planet and nothing would change in real life. So what we really need is effective marine protected areas.
Banning human activities like fishing in these protected areas without creating alternatives can mean a loss of livelihood for coastal populations. So, a key factor when it comes to designating these protected areas is to ensure that local populations are given alternative, sustainable employment opportunities.
We do not benefit from protecting the ocean or closing an area, for example, for fishing, and this in a local fishing village, and then depriving the whole community from their livelihoods. Then we would only, you know, relocate the problem. So when designating effective marine protected areas, many things need to be taken into account. This, as I said before, became obvious to me when I spoke to the local fishermen in Indonesia, because I speak Indonesian a little bit, and I talked with them, and this was very apparent. And there is a very, very nice example, actually, of how this can be dealt with. It's in Costa Rica. And how to deal with this issue is education. Without education, protected areas do not work, because then the local community does not understand why we're doing this and they are not on board. On the other hand, if you teach the local community and, for example, re-educate them from a fishing community, for example, to tourists, you can have a win-win situation. Because then you could educate the people and show them different ways, for example, how they could use this marine protected area as, for example, advertisement for eco-friendly tourism, and turn this whole area into an eco-tourism zone and switch from fishing to tourism. And with this, you would have the protected area, you would have the local community on board and the government, because you don't hurt the economy and you don't just deprive the people from their livelihoods, but you educate them. And for this reason, education is one of the main factors, a hugely important factor in designating effective marine protection.
In order to answer the theoretical question as to whether one can oblige countries to designate marine protected areas in the best possible way, Anna von Rebay tracked down practical, real-life examples. She travelled to protected marine areas in Australia and Indonesia and interviewed local fishermen there. Anna von Rebay's experience as a litigator enabled her to set up her doctoral thesis in the style of a real-life case. She focused on two activities which are particularly threatening to the biodiversity of our oceans.
And in order to support my arguments, I took two practical examples on which I wanted to show that we must stop states in some, you know, with certain activities. And the two activities that I looked at was deep sea bottom trawling, or bottom trawling in the high seas, and deep sea mining. Both are two activities that are majorly damaging for the ocean. Bottom trawling in the high seas is a fishing technique in which fishing boats have a trawl nets, and they have weights on each side on to hold them open and to put them down on the floor. They are called doors. They can weigh up to 5 tons each. And then the net is being dragged across the ocean floor on kind of wheels that are very, very heavy. So not only do these huge net sizes trawl and empty the ocean in an unsustainable rate, also the big metal or steel doors and the wheels, they just destroy everything that's down there. Scientists and biologists like the example of saying bottom trawling is as if you would like to hunt deer in a forest, And instead of going to the forest shooting the deer, you would bulldoze the whole forest and just try to pick the deer. This is a little bit how you can imagine bottom trawling. So the bycatch in bottom trawling is immense because it obviously cannot only, the net sizes are huge. So they cannot, they don't only go for the targeted species, and also going for the targeted species just overexploits them because no species can recover in such a speed. But it also completely destroys all coral and everything that's down there on the ocean floor.
Many countries' fishing industries use bottom trawling nets on the high seas. Unlike coastal areas, the high sea is open to all states, and no state may purport to subject any part of it to its sovereignty. The UN General Assembly is currently working on the publication of a resolution recommending that all states end bottom trawling.
And then the second activity I looked at, equally, you know, it's sickening, is deep sea mining. Deep sea mining is an activity to harvest and collect nodules from the deep sea floor that are very rich in, for example, manganese. We need these resources for different things in our high-tech life, like batteries. So they are very valuable. So states are keen. Also, Germany was for a long time. They have a zone. So the way that they do it, there are different techniques, but generally what happens is that there is a boat on the surface with a kind of a pipe that goes to the deep sea floor. So it can go down 4,000 to 7,000 meters. So really to areas that are completely unexplored. We do not know a lot about it. Like, we know so little about this area. So many areas of these parts in the ocean are still completely unexplored. And this pipe goes down to the ocean floor and kind of like a vacuum cleaner sucks in these nodules and pumps out the residue, everything else that it is not needed. There's a lot of chemical released in this process in the water. And also the ocean floor just gets completely destroyed and we do not know anything about it.
While some companies which depend on rare metals like manganese for their profits have even called for the suspension of deep sea mining until it is clear what the consequences are for the oceans, the Pacific island state of Nauru has urged the International Seabed Authority to lay down parameters within 2 years to enable seabed mining to take place. The deadline for this is August 2023, which makes a ban on deep sea mining increasingly urgent.
So it has become more urgent at the moment, and many states are trying to work together now that we try to find a stop and to this activity and prevent it from happening before it's too late. Because with the ocean, one thing has happened, which is very clear. Usually when we discover new territories, the way to go is that, you know, you discover the territory and explore it before you start exploiting it. And with the ocean, we have gone a different way. We have started exploiting the ocean before anything was known about the ocean. And now we know that we are starting to realize the consequences with fish that are extinct or getting extinct. And this is one of these examples that, you know, states would start exploiting the ocean before we even have explored it. So these are the two activities that I used as examples to demonstrate this obligation and make it obvious.
Citing the damage caused by deep sea mining and fishing with bottom trawl nets, and referring to the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, Anna von Rebay has drawn up clear arguments for the legal obligation of nations to designate marine protected areas.
So the legal obligation to designate marine protected areas in my doctoral thesis is built on one specific regulation of the United Nations Convention for the Law of the Sea, UNCLOS. The reason for doing this is the following. Well, there are about 300 instruments and regulations in marine protection law that provide some kind of protection. However, they are all limited, either because they protect a specific species or they protect a specific area or from a specific activity. But what I was looking for was a comprehensive protection regulation, something that would protect everywhere and everything from everyone. And luckily, we do have one very big international treaty for the law of the sea, the UNCLOS. The UNCLOS is now ratified or signed and ratified by 168 states and other entities, so it's widely recognized, however not universal. So when I started investigating the UNCLOS, one particular regulation came to mind, which is Article 192 UNCLOS. It says, all states are obliged to protect and preserve the marine environment.
Specialised literature argued that it was barely possible to derive legal obligations from this very broad formulation. Anna von Rebay remained undeterred and went on to prove in an initial step of argumentation that the statement, all states are obliged to protect and preserve the marine environment, was indeed legally binding.
Then the second step I had to take was to see who is bound by this regulation, only the 168 parties or everyone, because otherwise we have 168 parties that are bound by it, but the rest of the state community is not. So I investigated if Article 192 is not only a conventional regulation, but if it may have emerged into customary international law. And in this regard, I investigated, all plenary meetings of the General Assembly since the adoption of the UNCLOS in 1982 and statements of states in this regard. I looked at jurisdictions, national and international, and ultimately evidence, and came to the conclusion that no states, even the non-state parties such as the USA or Turkey or Venezuela, they opposed to the UNCLOS for various reasons. For example, the United Nations don't want to be bound by the deep seabed regulations. But they all uniformly agree and accept the obligation to protect the marine environment. So my second very big result was that the whole state community is bound by this regulation. So it is a really good one to build an obligation on if I manage.
This then led to the third and most difficult step in the process, the attempt to determine concrete obligations for states to protect the oceans.
So specific obligations of states that have an effect outside are regulated usually in administrative law. Administrative law shows a state or says actually what states do and their effect to a single person. And the jurisprudence in international law said that the obligation to protect the marine environment, under this obligation, states are obliged to protect the marine environment from future damages and have to preserve it in the way that it is right now. And another jurisprudence said that under this obligation, states are obliged to adopt specific measures, particular legislative measures. Legislative measures are part of administrative law. So I investigated first, are states under Article 192 really obliged to adopt legislative measures? Because legislative measures in national law is the adoption of legally binding laws. In international law, we don't really have that. So what comes closest to legally binding laws or to legislative measures is international treaties. So I first evidenced that under the obligation, states are obliged to adopt international treaties and national laws. And then there's the second big step. This is how, what do they specifically need to do? And the how is derived by the interpretation of the law. So what kind of protection measure needs to be adopted depends a little bit on what issues are out there.
That's because the law can only provide a framework. The essential information needed in order to formulate the obligation comes, in this case, from marine biologists, geologists, and marine conservation activists.
So this is when we start to interplay and to interact, because when the marine biologists and geologists give, you know, arguments and show me issues, the law gives me a very clever and sharp tool to translate them into a sharp weapon in which we can use their arguments in, for example, a lawsuit. So it depends also, of course, very much on the insights and the evidence that we have from biologists. There are many studies, and it should really be just so crystal clear on how devastating bottom trawling is. So using bottom trawling or deep sea mining as examples to manifest this obligations were just ways into showing how obvious it is that these activities must be prohibited. And one major problem, of course, is that as much as states are free to conclude treaties, they are also free to do what they want. And there is one very, very old regulation in the law of the sea, which says that the high seas are free and all states can do in the high seas whatever they want, basically. So with limiting the high seas, we, of course, infringe this freedom. So what also needs to be done is to find a balance between the protection of the marine environment on the one side and the freedom of states on the other side. And so the last part of this thesis was I used the examples of bottom trawling and deep sea mining to show that these freedoms are not unlimited and that they are conditioned by other regulations of international law, and that this interpretation and application of these examples to the law shows that the marine protection in these areas outweighs and that bottom trawling and deep sea mining must be prohibited.
After concluding her doctoral thesis, one thing was clear for Anna von Rehbey. She wanted to put the results of her study into practice. The main question for her was how she could best make use of her legal expertise within the field of marine protection. At the same time, she didn't want to be tied to one particular project, but wanted to be free to choose where she invested her time.
So I decided then, well, if I don't want to be employed and I don't want to do policy, I'll just open my own law firm and I'll just see how it goes. And this is how I opened Ocean Vision Legal. And honestly, ever since I started, I'm just amazed. In the beginning, I thought, oh, well, you know, marine protection, it's such a small field. I also need to do climate litigation because that's what everyone does at the moment. But it turned out very quickly that marine protection is such a big field and that there are so many people interested by now. So I do climate litigation because it's very interrelated with marine protection, but only where it's interrelated with marine protection. And I found my niche. And I found my niche with marine protection, and I'm just overwhelmed how well it's going. And I'm very, very happy about these amazing cases that I'm working on and about how I can really use what I learned, what I studied now in real life. And I'm so grateful and thankful for this. It's really amazing.
Anna von Rehbey's clients are foundations and environmental organizations based both in Germany and worldwide. This cooperation with foundations pushes the aim of her doctoral thesis back into focus.
Well, I do legal assessments on the admissibility of specific fishing techniques in the German territorial sea or the exclusive economic zone. So I look at whether we can close some areas to specific techniques that are very damaging and write the assessments to that and consult. Or I have international clients. For example, one of them is a very amazing Swiss foundation. They're called Gallifrey Foundation. And I'm working together with them, looking on a potential advisory opinion, which means we want to ask the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea for an advisory opinion on specific issues, for example, overfishing. And also the contents of my doctorate thesis, we are looking to putting that into an advisory opinion as well. And I'm already talking with specific, you know, some of these organizations for the funding. And currently we're also looking for states who want to support this advisory opinion, because one specific to international law is actually that also only states can sue or can act in front of the tribunals and courts. So we need states to act.
Since setting up Ocean Vision Legal in 2021, Anna von Riebeil has had a steady flow of new clients, so that she's begun employing staff to ensure that all inquiries can be taken care of. Anna von Riebeil intends to grow Ocean Vision Legal whilst keeping her passion for marine protection work very much in the foreground.
So we're really dedicated to the marine protection and to this side. And I'm having an amazing time connecting with people in the field. It's just amazing, the people that you meet and who are so passionate about it. And I think this is one very special thing about it, different than in other law firms in which people, you know, you do law and you do, I don't know, like family law, divorce law or whatever, criminal law, and you do it, maybe you even have a passion or you like it. But in marine protection law, everyone who is in this field is in it because they love it. And everyone who's in the field loves going diving and snorkeling and going out there by themselves. So it's not only theoretical, but you talk with people who share your passion. And this makes it a special branch, I think, because we all are in the field together to keep our passion alive. And that's the dream that I'm living, so I don't have any intention of changing anything at the moment.
Listen Up, der Podcast der Uni Potsdam.
Produziert von Speak Low im Auftrag der Innovativen Hochschule Potsdam.